From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks, Ollie. Well done. Cheers, mate. It is Monday, January 27, 2020. Hope you're well. Richie Allen here. Who else? With the Richie Allen Radio Show, broadcasting live on multiple platforms right now, including Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, the TuneIn Radio app, triggerwarning.tv, richieallen.co.uk. I've got two brilliant guests lined up for you today, and you can tweet the programme as usual. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter.
Well, ring out the gimp.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Why can't we have a rational, intellectual, sane, grown-up debate about the effects of mass migration on countries and societies like Ireland? Why can't we? Without it descending into accusations of xenophobia and bigotry. It's nonsense, isn't it? But that's the reality. I'll be joined by a household name at this hour. The writer, the author, the playwright, the very accomplished journalist John Waters joins me live on the line from Dunleary in Ireland. You don't want to miss him. We'll be talking about that and why he's chosen for the first time in his life to stand in the forthcoming Irish general election. So John Waters joins the programme this hour to talk about that. And in the second hour, brilliant health journalist, probably the best I've ever met, John Rappaport, is live from New York City for the first time in a long time. He's on the case of the coronavirus, its origins, what's really going on. Brilliant writer, nomorefakenews.com. John Rappaport joins me in the second hour. And as I've already mentioned, but it bears mentioning again, if there's something you'd like to contribute to the programme, do so through the medium of Twitter, tweet at Richie Allen Show, and I'll read the tweets out as they go along. Monday's programme, brand new week, and a thousand apologies that a half an hour into the live stream this morning, the newspaper thing, I was cut off in my prime. My internet provider went down for a couple of hours. In fact, I must admit, I dug out an email from them. I had been forewarned a week or so ago that today, the 27th, they would be tinkering and that we might lose broadband service in the morning. So apologies for that. I was going to go off on one about a couple of stories inside the papers, probably for the best that I was cut off, but I do apologise. These things happen, you know. So there you go. But worse things happen at sea, as the old saying goes. Yeah. Well, I'm all good. I'm a bit better in myself today, to be sure. And that's a good thing. Now, here's some news for you, Justin. 73 people in the UK have been tested for the coronavirus. 73. Do you want the results? Well, none of them. None. None of them are positive. Nobody tested positive for the coronavirus.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Who knows? Everybody who sneezes, everybody who has a runny nose will be running for the hills lest they be tested for the coronavirus. This is no joke. By the way, this is the collective media. I'm very cynical, as you know, because I've worked at every level of the media. I can say this. This is the collective media when they heard that nobody tested positive for corona. Yeah. Gutted. Absolutely gutted. I'm cynical, am I? I'm not cynical. I've got two friends who've worked at the BBC for years. One is retiring next year and he'll be on the programme then and he'll have a lot to say. And the other is based in the Far East and he's not far from retirement either. And both of them said to me, and I think I mentioned this before, that media has become so cynical that there is palpable disappointment. For example, if there are shots fired somewhere in London, possible terrorism, right? My mates have said that they've been disgusted to witness dismay among their colleagues if only one or two people are killed. Actual disappointment. That is the media in the 21st century. Okay. Anyway, on the 73 who didn't test positive for the coronavirus. Here's a Sky News reporter, Laura Bundock.
So 73 people in total in the UK have been tested for coronavirus. All of those have come back as negative. So to date, no confirmed cases of coronavirus. Here, obviously, they're continuing to monitor the situation. We get updates every day. So we'll hear again tomorrow if that situation has changed. But Public Health England have been making it very clear that the chance of a case in the UK is highly likely, and that it may well be the case that there is already somebody in the UK with the coronavirus. They just might not know about it. I think one of the concerns with this virus is that because it's a new virus, we don't know everything about it. And what seems to be coming out from the Chinese health authorities is that people can be presenting pretty much no symptoms and yet could be able to transmit the disease itself. So that's one of the worries, is that you could be carrying it, you might not be feeling unwell, but could you be passing it on to other people? And I think that's part of the reason why we'll be hearing a statement from the Health Secretary Matt Hancock in the next hour, outlining perhaps what the government strategy is based on the latest information out of China. Meanwhile, though, the Foreign Office is saying it is making efforts to try and get British nationals who are based in Wuhan out of the country if possible. That's not happened yet, and it's obviously a worrying time for people who are stuck there. I spoke to a man, Adam Bridgman, who's in Wuhan. He's just had his first baby, 4 weeks old, the son, and he's stuck inside his flat, unable to go out at the moment, can't come home yet earlier. Here's what he had to say.
This is good.
He had to say,
it's a bit stressful because the newborn baby that we've been told by the doctors to go to the hospital this week for a checkup, some kind of injection, or we can't really go there with this going on.
That's good. Good for the baby that he doesn't get injected with a toxic tidal wave of shit, including aluminium. So there is a blessing in disguise. The baby can't go and get his vaccine. Yeah. That's funny, isn't it? People displaying no symptoms whatsoever, but they might be carriers that they can pass it on. I'm not saying this is impossible now. I know this is a medical possibility, that you can carry it but not be affected and pass it on. That's going to be lovely in the near future when towns are being rounded up and sent off to camps. You might be a carrier. I'm sorry, you've got to get on the lorry. Get on the lorry! You might be a carrier. I know you're not sick, but you might be a carrier. Get on the lorry, says the man with the big rifle. Anyway, enough of that nonsense. I know, I'm at my worst on a Monday. I tend to get more mature as the week goes on. Right, Holocaust Day today. Coverage live from Auschwitz, world leaders, covered by Sky News all afternoon. I think BBC News 24 took it as well. People who had escaped Auschwitz or who survived it were speaking about it, poignantly, it must be said, poignantly, about their experiences there. And I watched a bit of it there. So the BBC says that this is all important because it's necessary to fight so-called resurgent anti-Semitism. Right, I won't bore you. You know what I think about that. So the presidents of Israel and Poland, Reuven Rivlin and Andrzej Duda, laid wreaths together 75 years after Soviet troops liberated the camp. Fair play to the BBC. Fair play to them. It was Soviet troops that liberated Auschwitz, not Yanks. Damn Yanks. About 1.1 million people, mostly Jews, were killed in Auschwitz-Birkenau. The Israeli president Rivlin warned of voices which spread hate and which threaten democracy. Yes. Our duty is to fight anti-Semitism, he said. And fascist nostalgia. Sick evils, he said. Okay. Blah, 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 blah. It's a sickness. I'll make this brief because you've heard me talk on it too many times before, and there might be, I don't know, Zionist lash. Not. All right, no, I am. I'm going to talk about it very briefly because I think it is important. I think it's a sickness, this spectacle at Auschwitz today. It makes me physically sick. And I'm going to qualify what I mean by that, because it's important. If your grandparents or great-grandparents suffered in Treblinka or Sobibor or Auschwitz or Dachau, who could possibly criticise you for remembering them and saying a prayer and lighting a candle? Who could criticise you? I certainly wouldn't. It was a terrible time. Unspeakable crimes were committed against groups of people. Jews, obviously, Soviets, Poles, Serbs, Romani, people with disabilities, physical and mental, homosexuals, of course, murdered, tortured, we know. And today we have this grotesque commemoration in Auschwitz. Why grotesque? Well, we heard the BBC, well, we heard, I read the BBC. The BBC said liberated by Russians. That's good. Largely, in the West, the idea that Americans liberated has gone unchallenged, but fair play to the BBC today. They said Russians did it. What's grotesque about it? Well, for me, you see, you've got the grotesque spectre of senior Israeli politicians speaking about never again, never again, never again should we let it happen, and condemning genocide, racism and bigotry, which should be condemned, of course. Genocide is not good. Racism is not good. Bigotry is not good. Speak about them by all means. But back home, you're prosecuting a genocide against the indigenous people of Palestine. Fact, not conjecture. And here's a bit of controversy for you now. I hope that those Jewish men and women around the world who have a stake in what happened in Nazi Germany, i.e. their family might have perished there, I hope they are outraged watching on television today at the Israeli war criminals and genocidal maniacs playing the victim again today. They should be outraged. If I was Jewish and my great-grandfather was murdered in Auschwitz, I'd be kicking off right now. And I've said again and again and again and again, don't confuse me. The world's Jews bear no responsibility for Gaza. Indeed, a great many of them condemn it. Remember, I've had them on the programme. I've had Jews on the programme who condemn what goes on in Gaza, acknowledge it as an apartheid, as genocide. So don't blame them for it. Like blaming a Jew in North Manchester or Benidorm or Los Angeles or Outer Mongolia, blaming them for Netanyahu, who is a Nazi war criminal, is silly, foolish, not their fault. And I just hope Jews watch today and are repulsed by the exploitation of their ancestors by psychotic mass murderers who behave like Nazis themselves. And why no mention today Holocaust Day of every other group of people murdered by the Nazis? Why not? Over 3 million Soviet prisoners murdered in German captivity. Over 3 million Soviet prisoners shot or starved to death deliberately. Not to mention millions upon millions of Soviet citizens, civilians, starved to death in Kharkiv, Kiev and Leningrad. The hunger planet was called. What about them? Did they not matter as well? Or is it just Jews we're talking about today? If you take Jews out of the equation, the vast majority of people, even with Jews in the equation, excuse me for being trite with the language I'm using, I'm a pretty simple bloke. The vast majority of people killed were not Jews. They were Slavs. They were Slavs, which means the Slavic languages, Ukraine, Russia, etc., etc. So why have ultra-Zionists been able to co-opt the Holocaust and claim it for themselves? Is it because it's part of this notion that Jews are exceptional, chosen, special, a group apart, unique in their suffering through the ages? Well, they're not. Of course, Jews have been scapegoated and targeted during human history, but not uniquely and not by a long shot. So it makes me sick today to witness this nonsense and to hear the lies about how anti-Semitism or Jew hatred is on the march here in the UK, which it isn't, because it's laughable in its absurdity. Our friends and neighbours who identify as Jewish are indeed a minority, but they're not vulnerable. Jesus, they're doing well by every measurement. Education, home ownership, employment. Jews are doing well, and the best of bloody luck to them. Who could begrudge them? What a spectacle, what a charade, what vaudeville that event at Auschwitz was today, to see war criminals, genocidal maniacs, with their Star of David flags, Zionists in government in Tel Aviv, who prosecute mass murder on the indigenous people of Palestine, fucking telling us never again. Practice what you preach, and then tell us never again. And get out of Palestine, where you don't belong, and then tell us never again, and we'll stand alongside you, you lunatics. 18 minutes past the hour. Right, so the UK government then, let's move on, is going to decide tomorrow on whether to ban equipment which is made by Huawei, which is obviously a massive Chinese technology firm. that equipment is meant to be used in rolling out 5G in the UK. Now, the United States is lobbying very hard to tell the UK to make the UK exclude Huawei on the grounds of national security, that Huawei will basically be a Trojan horse and feed information back to the Chinese government. Huawei says not a chance. We would never do it. It would be suicide, corporate suicide. We don't do that thing, they say. Johnson, Boris Johnson, is chairing a meeting of the National Security Council. The decision will be made. It won't be announced immediately. We might find out in the next couple of days. Conservative MP Tom Tugendhat was on Adam Bolton's Sky News programme this morning. He wants Johnson to exclude Huawei. Here he is.
No, this is an important question, and it's a difficult one because, as Tamara rightly said, there are implications for UK business on this. Delays to 5G will cost us, and there's no doubt about it. There is, however, a pretty clear way of looking at this, amongst others. Can you imagine a British company having the same access to China's telecoms?
Well, I don't know. We do make a lot of phones and things over there, don't we?
Yeah, but they're made by China. They're not, and then imported here. We don't have a similar network operating within China.
Well, we have American technology here. We have Scandinavian technology with Ericsson and Nokia. I mean, why is Huawei more of a security risk?
Huawei is, first of all, connected much more intimately to the Chinese state than any of these other companies connected to their respective governments. In fact, most of them are not connected at all. And the second reason is the Chinese state doesn't operate the same principles of rule of law or indeed civil rights that the other countries do. Another reason, of course, is that Huawei has already been linked to various espionage accusations in places like Uganda and Tanzania, and some other countries have been reputed to have installed Huawei kit that has since been sending packets of information back to Shanghai.
Adam Bolton is hard as nails. The studio could be burning to the ground and he's going to ask his questions. Fire alarm going off there in the background. And Bolton totally unmoved. By the way, don't hold your breath waiting for Adam Bolton to ask Tom Tugendhat for proof of what he said there at the end.
Accusations in places like Uganda. Another reason, of course, is that Huawei has already been linked to various espionage accusations in places like Uganda and Tanzania, and some other countries have been reputed to have installed Huawei kit that has since been sending packets of information back to Shanghai.
Yeah, don't hold your breath waiting for Bolton to ask him for proof that Huawei is sending packets of information, you know, data belonging to Uganda and elsewhere, that they send it back to Shanghai. He's accused them of a heinous crime there, with no evidence, and Bolton just sits there and nods along. Here's Bolton's next question.
I mean, do you think China is out to dominate and interfere in the British way of life?
Well, he just said that Huawei is sending pockets of or packets of information back to Shanghai in other countries where it operates, Adam. So yes, the toxic Tory Tom Tugendhat is spinning a whole ball of lies about Huawei and the Chinese and offering no evidence.
Well, I think it's not really surprising to say that China has been looking to collect intelligence on market-sensitive equipment and to develop a very advanced form of corporate espionage over the last 10, 15 years. We know that. That's not really a secret. And they've been pretty successful at it, frankly. If you look at many of their latest generation fighters, for example, they look remarkably like planes that were developed in the United States. But if you look at the way that Huawei is seeking market dominance, no, that's not unusual. Other companies do that. But the difference is Huawei is not interoperable, whereas Ericsson or Nokia or indeed Cisco, Samsung, Fujitsu or many others actually allow a sort of plug-and-play model, if you like, where they can work with other systems. Huawei does not. And it's pretty striking that even a communist country like Vietnam that has been traditionally, as you know, close to China, has decided that the risk from Huawei is too great and they are going to be running their own system.
Goodbye, Tom. Hear, hear. Fetch boy. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Tom Tugendhat there. Nonsense. Conjecture. Hyperbole. Not backed up by any evidence whatsoever. It'll be interesting to see what Johnson does. Excuse me for coughing in your ear there. I'm a good deal better, but still I'm still a little rough. I'm all right now, but you should have seen me the other day, you know. I can't wait to speak with John Waters. It's 23 minutes past the hour. Let's get John on the programme. Very accomplished and household name in Ireland, journalist, author, playwright John Waters is next. It is Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show. I'm Richie Allen. Welcome to the programme. Thanks for choosing me. Wang Chung on the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. That's all good. Looking forward to speaking to John Waters. John is standing by and he'll be with me in a couple of seconds' time. Try to ring him there and there was an issue. I'm going to get him to ring me. It works better when he rings me, maybe. I asked the question at the very top of the programme. I asked, why can we not have a conversation about the effects of migration on societies, on countries in Western Europe? Why can't we do that without people being accused of xenophobia and bigotry and small-mindedness? Why can't we do it? I've been in radio production and television production and presentation for, well, 20-odd years. And even back in my days at WLRFM in Waterford, when there was a huge influx of asylum seekers to the seaside town of Tramore, ordinary men and women in Tramore couldn't get on the radio to talk about the impact it was having on them without being accused of racism and snobbery and bigotry and all the rest of it. There's something very wrong here. I don't like it. And I'm joined now by, I have to say, an incredibly accomplished journalist, author and playwright, who I mentioned earlier on is a household name back home and beyond, writing with distinction for years in the Irish Times, the Sunday Independent, just to name two newspapers as well. And his writing is thought-provoking, triggering even these days. He might laugh at that, triggering. I think his is an important voice, I really do. And Jean-Anne Crowley, who's a big part of this programme, does a lot of research for me, an amazing woman, sent me his most recent book about a year ago called Give Us Back the Bad Roads, and it's a must-read. Very poignant me reading that because I've not been home for 16 years. He's a candidate in the 2020 Irish general election for Dún Laoghaire, the constituency there, and he's running under the Anti-Corruption Ireland banner. I'm delighted that, for the first time I'm speaking to him, but he did speak to my radio programme back in the 90s and early noughties when Billy McCarthy was alive at WLRFM, God rest his soul. Massive welcome, Cade Mila Fáilte, to John Waters. John, welcome to our programme. How are you?
Thank you very much, Richie.
Lovely to have you on, John. And the obvious question, first of all, is a journalist yourself, an important voice in critiquing the establishment, the government, the country. You haven't joined the establishment, but you're doing that establishment thing. You're running for MP. Why now? Why did you decide to do it?
I think that the problem has been that we are in an abnormal situation, and much as I would like to continue my life or have continued my life as it was, say, 10 years ago, that has been taken away now. You know, we are now in a complete free fall with regard to many things in our society. First of all, the media. I couldn't any longer countenance continuing as a journalist because the media in Ireland had become so completely uniformly corrupt that they were interested only in pushing agendas and pushing the governmental line on many things. You know, it was very hard to work out what would be going on. I'm beginning to form such pictures now, and they relate to what you're talking about, but I've managed to get under this in my head now in ways that I think might be helpful to people who are perhaps scared off from speaking by these kind of smears. And so I've kind of decided that, you know, if these people who have been in power for 10 years now get another 5 years, they will finish the country off. So somebody has to do something, if only to try and alert their fellow countrymen to the crisis we're facing.
You say finish the country off, and I certainly wouldn't put words in your mouth. You'll explain it yourself. But is this what a lot of people fear? You're talking about that the Irish are becoming a minority in their own country. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yes, a French writer called Renaud Camus calls it the Great Replacement, which is a Europe-wide phenomenon. And to be honest with you, Richie, even a very short time ago, I would have been kind of very reluctant to use this language. But the more I look into it now, the more I realize this is the only possible explanation for what's happening. If you think about what you were saying there about these smears about xenophobia and racism, that's a screen which is used by people, politicians and their shills, their paid lackeys out there in the culture who are using, you have basically a license to go out and intimidate their fellow citizens, to block meetings, stop meetings from happening, to cancel people, to attack people physically. It's happened here in several times now in the past year or so, attacks on people who take certain views on Irish society physically and so on. So this is like, you see, we could fall into the trap of thinking, and sometimes in a part of one's head, these slurs have a capacity to wound. That's a big mistake to allow that to happen to you, or at least not to have a mechanism to counteract it, because it is purely a device to stop people seeing something that is much, much bigger and has nothing to do with compassion or humanitarianism or anything like this. This kind of stuff, this guff really that they're all spouting, you know, about, you know, being kind to migrants and refugees and asylum seekers. It is complete nonsense. Hardly any of these people are asylum seekers. Hardly any of them can be described as refugees. They are migrants. And they are not individual migrants. They're coming in masses, in waves. If you look now at Ireland's situation, like just as a brief map of it over my lifetime. I mean, when I was born in the mid 50s. At that time, we were at the peak of a mass wave of emigration out of Ireland. I know you left yourself in probably what, about the 90s, was it, or so?
2002, John. Yeah, not 16, 17 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this was the first wave. Now, between 1945 and 1960s, 500,000 people left Ireland. And that seems shocking. But in fact, from 2008, to the present, something like the same number has left Ireland again, right? And something like 5 to 6 times that number have been admitted from outside. Now think about that. We're incapable of looking after our own people to the extent that they have to leave to go to Australia and America, but we can welcome in half the world, it seems. What's that about? Well, it's this guy I told you about, Camus. He describes it as devocracy. So it's about Davos, the city or the town of Davos in Switzerland, where all these people go to meet every year and plan how they are going to rule the world and continue this globalizing tendency, if you like. And essentially, therefore, we are in the grip of this now in Ireland. Our leaders are no longer our leaders. At least they are no longer our representatives. At the very minute, I was saying this today to people, you know, that as you walk around Dunleary now, you see these posters. I have a few, not many. But most of the posters you'll see smiling down at you, most of those faces, are people you will only see this once in the next 4 years.
Yeah, that's right.
That they will get their stamp on their ballot paper and they will then be elected. And they will then, not alone will they become invisible to you, inaccessible to you, but they will work determinedly against your interests as an Irish person. And they will work in the interests of multinational corporations, the EU, the UN, and also then at the lower level, in the interests of migrants who come here at the behest and instruction of these bodies. And also, of course, at the behest now, again, the politicians of Google, Facebook, Twitter, the major multinationals in the big tech sector and also the big pharma sector and so on, which has been going on for a long time now. So our leaders are not our leaders, are not our representatives. And will use another 5 years of what they've been doing. We now have something like officially 17%, over 17% of our population is non-national. That's more or less the same as the UK's population configuration. The difference is it took 60 years of mass migration into the UK to reach that level. It's only taken 20 years of mass migration into Ireland to achieve the same per capita proportions. So we're really far down the road now in all kinds of ways, under the multinationals' control of things, under the migration situation and so on. I mean, there was an extraordinary tragic demonstration over the weekend, a place called Mulhoddart. The residents were complaining about the fact that houses were being allocated to migrants over the heads of people who had, local people who had been on the housing list for many years. And these poor people who have been bullied by politicians and priests and journalists were pleading for what? They were pleading to be given a 50% share of the houses which Irish taxpayers will be paying for.
I saw that statistic, and like yourself, I'm certainly not like you. I mean, you're a journalist in every sense of the word, but I do like to check things and to do my own looking into it, and I found that to be true. I also found it to be true back in the early 2000s before I left Waterford. You know, there were things happening at the South Eastern Health Board and I was being told about it and I didn't believe it. I was a little bit like you. I was reluctant, or maybe I just didn't want to talk about it or think about it, maybe for fear that I would be accused of bigotry. I was hearing things like great favouritism was being shown to people from outside the country at the South Eastern Health Board, and our listeners overseas won't know, and I've got a lot of listeners in America and in the UK, they won't know what I mean by this, but it was kind of your last place to go if you had absolutely nothing, and if your dole was stopped for some reason and you needed something, a pair of shoes or some clothes, you'd go to your health board and you'd basically beg for it.
Yes.
And I did a bit of research then and I found out it was true, and we were encouraged at the radio station not to get into it. Amazingly, it was true. People were being favoured, and I looked into that research you just said there. I want to ask you this. You talked about, you didn't mention Antifa by name, but you've got these so-called anti-fascist movements. They are extreme fascists who believe that it's okay to beat people up because people decide to have a meeting and to talk these issues out. These are fascists. Yes, they're there. But I also know, and you know better than me because you're still living at home, there's a wider population in Ireland whom are genuinely opposed to what you're saying and what I've said on this show and what I've heard on this show. And they seem to be completely disenfranchised from this. It's almost like it goes completely over their heads and they look down their noses. You know, they almost don't want to be tainted by it. You know, they think that it's kind of gutter politics or it's very lowbrow stuff. Why is that, John? Because these are not bad people. These are our countrymen and women. Why do they not know and why do they not want to know?
Well, it's a number of things, Richie. First of all, it's the power of propaganda. And I wrote about that in great detail in my book, Give Us Back the Bad Roads, about that, the use of propaganda to push through gay marriage and abortion and all these things in the past decade in Ireland. That's one of the factors. The other factors are that people are, you know, that they're intimidated by these catchphrases, racist, bigot, xenophobe. These are the late Roger Scruton, the English philosopher who died only last week, he designated those words as what he called spell words. They're words which are obviously not used for informational purposes or for communication. They're used words which are used in effect to smear the recipient or the subject of them. And you know, I found this over many years where I'd be called a misogynist or a homophobe or whatever it would be. The latest one is racist, of course. But you see, this has the effect of scaring everybody who knows you, who doesn't know how to decipher and deconstruct that kind of word and how it works and who's using it and why are they using it. It's very hard to communicate. So people who are busy with their own lives, who have to get up in the morning and sit in traffic for 2 hours or whatever it would be, do not have the time to do this kind of delving into the meaning of things. And so they really, it's not that they necessarily believe the word, but they sure as hell don't want people turning around and pointing at them and calling them racist, because they won't have the equipment to answer. Now, it's very interesting you say this, Richie, but I mean, I've been on, I'd no longer go on the mainstream media in Ireland, for example, on radio or television. I was on millions of times on those things when I was a journalist. I stopped being a journalist here 5 years ago. And I don't go on now on radio or television, and I don't really read the newspapers, you know. So I'm kind of out of the loop. But I have been online on several channels talking at length, and that's a different thing on YouTube or whatever, you know, that this is a new phenomenon where people go on there and they have long conversations, detailed conversations about things like this.
Plenty of time. Yeah, plenty of time. Yeah.
And they and they can tease out the details of it. Now, I've done that for over the past years. I was ill during the year, so there was a kind of an extended break. But since, for the past year and a half, say, there's videos all over the place which have me speak, feature me speaking about these things. And I have many enemies out there in the public realm. There are people who spend their lives trying to find a word or a half sentence that they can use to smear me with out of my own mouth.
That's true.
Not a single sentence or word of anything I have said in that period has been used in that way. Because anybody who listens to what I say cannot say that I am speaking in a racist way. I have spoken in great depth about the relationship between Ireland and Africa, the comparisons to be made, the general situation, the colonial situation, the post-colonial situation. I know a good deal about these things. I have been to Africa innumerable times. I know what I'm talking about. And these people know they can't touch me with that stuff. And all I would say to people is that they will need to just pause. Let go of your prejudices, because you've been filled with prejudice by people who have a vested interest in placing those prejudices there. And listen with an open heart and an open mind to what people are saying. Because I promise you, in Britain as much as in Ireland, or even more, you're well down the road in certain respects there, because you have ghettoization, balkanization now at a level that we don't yet have. Our countries are being destroyed in front of our eyes. It has nothing to do with racism. It has got to do with a plan which is hatched mainly by white people, if you want to put it in color terms, to basically maximize the the financial aspects of things, to make economies work more effectively, more efficiently, to create more consumption. To break, and to do that, to cut people's roots to their place of origin, to cut people's sense of raising their heads to look at higher things, at the flag, at the idea of at the heavens in search of a God, for example, all of these things, to prevent them seeing the natural family as a fundamental unit group of society, to try to insinuate that there is any collection of individuals with a child can be called a family. This kind of stuff has been going on now for many years, and it is working its way into the consciousness of almost everybody, including mine. And it has taken me a good few years stumbling into these questions. I didn't volunteer, for these things. I was asleep at the wheel for a long time, Richie, on these questions. Because I started off as a kind of a lefty liberal. And it's only through a certain journey that I started to ask myself questions. For example, when I became a single father back 24 years ago, I thought that, a father would get respect, that it was, a matter of course. I then found that illegally I had no rights over my own child, no rights to have a relationship with my own child other than by concession of the mother or of the state or both. And I thought this was a fundamental injustice of the kind that left liberal people anywhere, everywhere, would be very interested in. And I, as you might say, went back to my former compadres on the left liberal wing and said, come quickly, you'll never guess what's happened here. Wait till you see what I've found, this terrible injustice. And of course, we're very interested in righting wrongs and resolving injustices, aren't we? And what do? They tried to kick my head in, yeah. Shut me up. And they've been doing that ever since. And that awoke me to the fact that if they were completely hypocritical about that, then the chances are they were wrong and hypocritical about everything else as well.
Well, the left, the left transformed in the 90s, didn't it? My greatest, not influences, I'm going to sound like a pretentious arsehole, and I'm a lot of things, but I might be an arsehole, I'm not a pretentious arsehole, but I've been very interested, in the writings over the years of Bolivar, Chavez. I'm a real old kind of socialist, me. And, I'm very interested in socialism and the left and how it's transformed in the last 30, 40 years. Because you talked earlier on about the impact of migration on Ireland. And obviously Eastern European migration, countries joining the European Union, has had a big effect on Ireland. Competing for maybe lesser skilled or semi-skilled jobs, making it more difficult for people to get those jobs, because all of a sudden you're not 20 people going for the job, you might be 100 people going for the job. And I've been able to discover through interviewing trade unionists who were very prominent in the 1980s, and you know this, John, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, But lefties then, if you want to call them lefty socialists, they were very much concerned and wary of the European Union. And they were very wary about the impact that an influx of migrants would have on the indigenous people. And it was open conversation then. People could talk about it then. You could say in the northwest of England or the northeast, you know, Jesus, we've only got so many factories and we've only got so much industry. We need to have jobs for our people. And if a lot of people come in, well, holy God, you know, that's not going to be good. These things could be said. But there's been some sort of transformation of the left, hasn't there? Where it's kind of gone 180.
Yes, there has. Sorry.
No, go ahead, John. Yeah, you've seen it yourself.
Well, I mean, the left is no longer the left in a certain sense, in the sense that we would use the word in the context you're talking about there, which the left is no longer that.
No.
I mean, the left used to represent, in English terms or in Irish terms, in Dublin terms, Ireland as a whole is somewhat different, as you know, because it's predominantly agricultural outside the main cities. But in the cities, in the urban context and in England generally, the left represented what were called the blue-collar workers, the working classes, right? So they were the ordinary working people of Britain and Ireland. And that was true. And the same was true in America. The Democratic Party actually represented those people for up to relatively recent times. And sometime in the last 20 years, 30 years, there's been this monumental shift whereby the people on the left have ceased to represent them gradually and left them high and dry and have, in favor of them, chosen to pick up what you might call the victim classes, the minorities. And they start to pursue issues to do with these minorities. It's identity politics, feminism, LGBT, race-related, and so on. And so now what you actually find, say, we're looking at the Democratic Party in the United States, is that their client base is made up of two very clearly different categories. At the bottom end, you have these minorities, many of whom are immigrants, whom they deliberately allowed to come in illegally so that they will become voting fodder for the Democratic Party. And at the other extreme, you have the very rich and the kind of professional classes, the people, if you like, who belong now to what you might call the virtual economy, involved in finance and communications and these forms of marketing, all of these things. And in between, the class which the left used to represent, the blue-collar workers, has been abandoned by the Democratic Party and taken up by whom? By Donald J. Trump. He was the one who saw that they were hanging, because the policies that I talk about later, where they are seeking basically to use mass migration to drive down wages all over the globe, and basically which has an effect of driving out the indigenous populations because they have commitments, they have family, they live in an economy that requires higher wages than the incoming population require. And so you get this effect whereby even Western economies are basically being driven downwards in terms of their cost base for manufacturers and industrialists and so on, and so on, banks and so on. But the people who used to work in the industries, which are now being, they're being moved to China or whatever, you know, they're all out. That's what's happening in France, for example, that you have the yellow vests who are now saying, we're here. We still exist. You will not destroy us. You will not replace us, as Renaud Camus says. You know, that this is what's going on, that the left no longer are the left in that sense. They are a different category. They represent the very rich. And in what you might call, I won't say very poor, because that actually wouldn't be true, but what you might call the subsidized classes at the bottom end. And the subsidized classes are effectively used as a shield, a moral shield, by the rich to say, we're for the underdog, when really they're for themselves. And that's the Democratic Party, and it's most of the parties now operating in that way throughout the Western world.
John Waters is our guest, and John's going to stay with us till the top of the hour, maybe till 5 past the hour. This is important stuff. JohnWaters.ie is the website. Very accomplished, very famous journalist and author is John, and he's standing in the forthcoming Irish election, which is going to be upon us right soon, really. You can follow him on Twitter right now. It's VoteJohn2020. Couldn't be simpler. VoteJohn2020. Lots of comments coming in on Twitter here. Loads and loads of questions about it. John, you said that you've abandoned the media back home, TV and radio. You spoke very, you made a very important point about, and again, I know this well from my time in media. You know, these issues are given six and a half, 7 minutes on national radio. It's ridiculous. I used to do it myself. It's nonsense. And you're talking to independent media sources. You get more time. But kind of another way, you're going about it another way. You're trying to reach the electorate through, I suppose, canvassing as you are now in this forthcoming election.
Yes.
But a lot of the discourse that is being had about this, it's all one-sided, of course, is happening on social media. This is some phenomenon, this, isn't it? In the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, you're, as well as a journalist, you're I look upon you as, you know, a kind of a student of human moves, as all the great writers are, studying people, observing people. And what have you made of the advent of social media and the impact that it has had on discussions like the ones we're having today?
I have very mixed feelings about it. I mean, as you say, I'm now for the first time on Twitter in the last 10 days or whatever it is. You know, there is an account, as you say, under that name. And that's a kind of essential now if you're going to communicate with people, because these are the channels which have been opened up for public discourse. But from the other end, I regard many aspects of social media as deeply damaging to democracy and to our capacity to have proper conversations, because Twitter in particular has been used really as a kind of a weapon of silencing, because it unleashes mobs in the direction of certain people and who offend against the verities of our culture now, of the official culture. And what you find is that media, mainstream media in general, are tuning into Twitter. So they amplify what's on Twitter, even though that may be only a tiny number of people who are stirring things up in that way. And that can be actually fatal for somebody professionally. In a very short time, overnight, you can be destroyed. And it has happened innumerable times with people. It happened to some extent with me when I took on the LGBT mob over their attempt their successful attempt to do a smash and grab on the Irish Constitution. And in effect, they succeeded by overturning the natural definition of family, parenting and marriage, and replacing it with something which is meaningless now. And I didn't particularly care whether they got married or not, but I didn't want them interfering with the Constitution, and I didn't want them having rights over other people's children, which they now have. So I got attacked. I hadn't even at that point stated my case, but because it was known that I was a Catholic, I was attacked, on a prima facie basis, you know, if you like. And so what we have is a strange kind of... I wrote an article there. I write for First Things in American magazine, and I wrote an article based on... I was very ill last year, as I mentioned, and still am a bit. I'm actually deaf in my left ear. And I have two conditions in that ear. One is called tinnitus, which is well known. It's musicians get it from loud noises nearby them, near loud music over many years. I got this as a result of a virus. And the other one is called hyperacusis, which is really a distorted receiving of noise in an incomprehensible way. In other words, if a motorbike passes, I hear it in some way without hearing it in my bad ear, but it amplifies through my whatever circuit I have. So it drowns out anything that I can hear with my good ear. And the same happens in a bar or a cafe or whatever. So I can't actually hear people at all in a conversation in a bar now. And I think Twitter is the same thing. I wrote the article that Twitter does the same thing to our society, that you only hear the loudest, nastiest noises. You don't hear anything thoughtful. It's not possible any longer for thoughtful ideas to breathe in our society.
And context is gone, John, out the window, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. It is. It's a very malign development in my view. And I'm kind of reluctantly on it because I've been advised that I have to do it. You know, it's a sine qua non now, apparently, of fighting elections. Even Trump was on it. In fact, Trump was on it more than anybody. But you see, and I can see the logic of that. I can see why, how he does it, because it allows him to bypass the mainstream media, which, as I said, in Ireland is profoundly corrupt. Which refuses to actually, if I go on the Irish media, if I'm stupid enough to go on with anybody or go do an interview with a newspaper, I will just be ambushed. And 99% of what I say will be ignored. And one line that I say which can be twisted in some way, will be used as a headline to make me look bad in some way or other.
And that's a horrendous thing, because I remember watching you. Look, you're only a little bit older than me. I'm 45, but I do remember watching you on The Late Late Show. I've been engaged in politics since I was very young. I was a boring, dull kid. I was interested in things my mates weren't. I mean, I played football and soccer and everything else, but I loved watching the debates when Gabo had a panel. There was nothing like it. It was magnificent, and you were on many of them. And you had plenty of time, and things were fleshed out, and nobody was kind of attacked in an ad hominem way. Nobody would deign or stoop to doing that. Jesus, how has it gone so bad, you know?
And there were no ambushes, you know? I mean, you kind of knew that the things you had to deal with, more or less, you know. Maybe Gabo would think of something in the middle of the program that it hadn't occurred to him before, but it would be in good faith.
It was honest, yeah.
And your response would be treated in good faith. There wouldn't be like this kind of Paxman-esque kind of prosecutorial approach to things. You know that kind of Jeremy Paxman thing that, he, did you or did you not do say this? And did you say this? And the same question asked 500 times, you know. Like, you see, this is not what a conversation is. And that kind of... what actually has arisen from that is that politicians will not go on media now unless they're trained up to their ears with spin technique and all this kind of stuff. So you're not getting a genuine response from them anywhere. I'm fully a believer in going on like with somebody like you, and ask me anything you like. I'll answer it in good faith. I mightn't know the full facts at any given moment, but I will try in good faith to give you a response and have a genuine conversation. You're not able to do this now in the mainstream media in Ireland, because they are there. The journalists are there. They're assassins, essentially. That's what they are. I mean, they don't really think of themselves in the way that we used to think of ourselves as, you know, trying to find out what was going on, trying to make interesting articles or programs. In fact, I found out in the last 15 years in going on radio programs, it began to strike me about 15 years ago that researchers and producers of radio and TV programs seem to have become more interested in vindicating their own positions, their ideological positions, the ones they adhered to or supported, much more interested in that than they were in actually having a fiery, interesting discussion, which would actually throw up new ideas or arguments. And I found that completely anathema in terms of being a journalist. It's not what journalism is.
No, but you were brought up to... we learned, because we're... well, again, there's a little bit of difference between us, but we're from the same generation. We learned to cope with our friends and our schoolmates disagreeing with us fundamentally. And we learned how to cope with that without falling out with them. And we learned how to... didn't we? We learned how to debate. I mean, I was in a debating society when I was in secondary school. And I learned pretty quickly to grow a bit of a thick skin, that when somebody completely disagreed with me, it wasn't personal. But again, that seems to have, I don't know, kind of seeped out of society.
Oh, yeah.
It's gone,
You're so right, Richie. I mean, like, my first book, Jiving at the Crossroads, which I wrote back in the early 90s, is kind of fake. It focuses on my father and his van, which is a mail car, which he used to drive around Roscommon and parts of Mayo. And he also used to carry passengers and newspapers and all kinds of stuff. But the van, when he would be going around, like from Castlereagh to Ballyhadreen or whatever, I'm back in the middle of the day, would be like a bus. And you would have maybe, I swear to God, like maybe up to 20 people in a Thames 800 van, and or minibus, and no seats, sitting on mailbags and all that, arguing about everything, right? Different people shouting, roaring, you know, and him in the front wavering all over the road, and he'd be the kind of the referee sometimes and the provocateur in other times. This, to me, is Ireland. Now, people are afraid of their shadow. If you raise any subject in front of most people in Ireland now, they'll kind of look around them before they'll answer you. People are being terrorized by the media. This is an extraordinary thing, and by these spell words that have been thrown around. Oh, you're a homophobe. I wouldn't hope you're not a homophobe. And our children are being taught to use them against us. You see, this is a very profound culture change and a very insidious one. You know, that people's children are now nailing them to the wall about their attitudes to this, that, and the other. You know, I've, a friend of mine told me that he was walked into the room one day, the sitting room, with a cup of tea for his wife, and they were all sitting around the TV watching Coronation Street, and there was something on about a gay couple, and one of them had his tongue down the other one's throat. Now, I don't watch Coronation Street recently, but he just said something about it. Oh, I'm out of here, you know. And the daughters set upon him, are you a homophobe?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, when did this start happening? And this is not spontaneous or naturalistic. This is actually orchestrated at a deep culture level and has been planned for many, many decades. And this is what I wanted to set out in the book that I wrote a couple of years ago, that actually this is actually, there's a history to this that goes way back. People are unaware of it. They think it's spontaneous. They think these things just come up because, well, it's 2018.
Yeah,
or it's
2018, yeah, yeah.
You know, or it's, oh, well, if it's 2020, it must be time for euthanasia. You know, that kind of thing. People actually accept that. Oh, well, we have to move with the times now, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of guff, like.
Are you talking cultural Marxism, John? There's a bit of that there, is there?
It is, yes, it is. That is actually what it is. Although I personally think that the term is inadequate because it's more than Marxism. You know, there's an awful lot of other elements and ingredients in it, you know, Freudianism and Nietzscheanism and a whole lot of things. But yeah, fundamentally, it's that idea. And that goes back to what we're talking about the change in the meaning of the word left, where this group called the Frankfurt School, who started in Germany in the 1920s and then moved to New York. Because why? Because in the 30s, because why? They were mainly Jewish people and they were escaping the Nazis. And in the Columbia University there, they worked there and they developed a whole lot of new ideas, which go back to a guy called Adorno and Gramsci is another guy. You know, he was the Italian intellectual who started a lot of this thinking. And essentially what they were dealing with was the idea that the proletariat in Marxian terms had failed to step into their historically allocated role of taking charge of the dictatorship of the proletariat, because fundamentally working people, all they wanted was better lives, more comfortable lives, nicer houses, a bit more money, you know, less stress. That was what they wanted, as you could well imagine they would. And so there was a gap in the Marxist agenda for a new proletariat. And the essential role of the Frankfurt School was to develop the ideas which we now deal with, which is development of this kind of what you might call a coalition of victims or a coalition of victim groups who now make up the new proletariat, who are now blackmailing the world under the claim that they have been oppressed in history. And that's what I mean by LGBT, feminism, the whole race thing. Trans now is the big one. Douglas Murray, yeah. The English journalist, has a wonderful book out called The Madness of Crowds, which is all about this. And he really nails it, you know, the whole thing. And but it's now prevalent everywhere in the Western world. And it's very strong in Ireland. In fact, in Ireland, bizarrely, which, you know, was always regarded as a backward country, we have now moved to the front almost. And we have become, you know, in Rod Little's phrase, he said it was Canada, I question that, the most batshit crazy country in the world.
That brings us back full circle, because it's where we came in. There is a problem. There is a huge problem, a cultural problem, and a huge impact on Irish society as a result of this unfettered migration over the last 20 years. And because of everything we've been discussing in the last half an hour, it can't be talked about. Because yes. People are marginalised, they're banned, they're kicked off, they're labelled, or they're shanghaied. In your case, I mean, you're well able for it, but they bring you onto a radio programme or television and try and hijack you for 6 or 7 minutes, and people can't talk about it. We've got about 3 minutes. I want to ask you a favour. Got about 2 minutes left, really. This is my fault. I should have asked you to do this in the week. I know you're going to Balbriggan later on. We should have done an hour or 90 minutes. So I'll ask, after the election, come back on and do a show with me, and we'll spend an hour and a half talking about these issues.
Two hours we can manage, John.
I'd be delighted, because there's so much we haven't covered today.
That's right.
I want to remind our... Go ahead, John. But just before you do, because I'm going to give you the final word, I do want to remind our listeners, John is running in Dunleary in the election, which is on February 8th. And he is on Twitter at VoteJohn2020. He's on he's under the Anti-Corruption Ireland banner. Gemma O'Doherty's been on this programme several times over the last couple of years as well, talking about these issues. So if you're in Dunleary, listen to what the man is saying. And if you are a voting person, think about the issues that you're not hearing about on the 9 o'clock news or on the 6 o'clock news, and listen to people like John Waters and read the books. And again, before John has the final word, I can't recommend highly enough John's books, and particularly Give Us Back the Bad Roads. It's a great read. And I meant to John when I said earlier on, when Jean Ann sent it to me, have I not been home? I've not even set foot in the country for 16 years. It was a very emotional read for me, that. So thanks for writing it.
Thank you so much.
It's brilliant, mate. And we've got, let's say we've got 90 seconds left. They're yours. Okay. I won't interrupt you. Go ahead.
There's a very central point I want to reiterate, and that is that that people, whether in England or Britain, Ireland or whatever, who have to face these slurs that you will get when you try to talk into your way into these questions, that what's actually happening is not what it seems. You know, it's not that what you're saying is offensive by definition to anybody. It's not that the people accusing you care about the people they're accusing you apparently on behalf of. It's that actually these people, the migrants, are being used as a weapon of effectively of cultural war, and you might say cultural genocide. And therefore, they're using these kind of pseudo-humanitarian tricks to silence people. You know, that we care for these people. They're vulnerable. They're running away from wars. They're not. They're in need of refuge. They're not. They're you know, coming. They're coming from Africa or whatever because they're allowed to come to Ireland. And the point I keep saying to people, well, if you leave the gates open, you'll have a full country in no time, and it'll be a lot fuller than you can imagine. So what I'm saying is that people need to actually get out from under the slurs and the spell words. Because otherwise, we will lose our countries. We will lose our homes. I mean that in the biggest sense. The home that we built with our neighbors and our communities for our children and our children's children will be taken away and given away by the people we have elected to represent us. And I don't care what color people are who are in Ireland. I couldn't care less. But the one thing I do know is that people who have worked all their lives in Ireland and to whom Ireland belongs as of right, as of birthright, have a right to question when their country is flooded with aliens and outsiders. And I will not be silenced in that crusade, just to question what's happening, and if I can, to prevent it.
John, thanks for coming on today. I wish you all the best next week. You know how difficult it's going to be, what you're up against. I'm not being defeatist here, of course, I'm not. And again, I want to mention, folks, go to johnwaters.ie. John's books on these subjects over the years. His articles are all online still, thank God. The articles he's written for years in the Irish press on all of these issues, hugely important. Check him out. And please, John, please come back in a few weeks' time after the election and do a full show.
I mean, it would take a miracle for me to win a seat. But I never rule out miracles, Richie, you know.
Never know. There's a tipping point somewhere eventually, isn't there?
Yeah.
John, thanks so much. God bless.
Thank you. God bless you.
Thanks, John. The brilliant John Waters, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Monday, January 27th, 2020. Yeah, Give Us Back the Bad Roads. I think 6 or 8 months ago, Jean Ann sent that to me as a prezi. Said, you have to read that. She's sharp, that Jean Ann Crowley, you know. Knowing my relationship with Ireland, which is a difficult one to say the least, you know. And it's an amazing read. She'll ring me now tomorrow, the day after. She'll challenge me. No, I did read it. I've got it here. It's in the studio with several books that I've read that she sent to me and others in the last year or so. John Waters, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Right, very quick message. And then John Rappaport is standing by in New York City. And we're going to talk all things. What's it called again? The coronavirus. Yeah, that's it.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Right, welcome back to the Richie Allen Radio Show. Good to be with you. This is music from the Stereo MCs. On the other side of this, we're off to New York City. John Rappaport joins me. Nothing like the Richie Allen Radio Show, Europe's most listened to independent show by a mile. Right, music from the Stereo MCs on the Richie Allen Radio Show. The time is 11 and a half minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the programme. A lot of comment there on John Waters on Twitter. If you want to see what people tweeted me, just put Richie Allen Show into Twitter, all one word. All one word. If you press enter, you'll see the hundreds of tweets that come into the programme every hour. Now, let me read you a couple of paragraphs. This, the latest from Sky News in London. Anyone in the UK who has recently arrived from Wuhan, where the deadly coronavirus broke out, is now being urged to self-isolate. That was said by the Health Secretary Matt Hancock in the last hour. He said travellers who have returned from the Chinese city in the last 2 weeks should stay at home, not to contact other people, and to ring the emergency NHS number if they feel unwell. Wow. He said officials are trying to trace nearly 1,500 people who landed in the UK from the wider Hubei province. This is staggering stuff. 73 people have been tested for the virus in the UK. They've all come back negative. The hysteria, well, it's almost overwhelming. It's non-stop on UK television and radio, and it has been for a number of days. It's been too long since our next guest was on this programme. I love the man. You know this because he gets mentioned often. He's a brilliant writer. Outstanding. For me, he's the go-to guy when it comes to matters health. He's broken more exclusive stories on health in the US and in Europe and around the world in the last 20 years than anybody else. He's written several books as well. Five, I think, on these subjects, and every major newspaper you can think of has had his byline. He's written for. He's written extensively on this issue, and you can read his articles on this issue at nomorefakenews.com. Thank God to cut through all the nonsense. We've got John Rappaport back on the programme to talk about this. John, welcome back. How are you?
Okay, Richie. Too long since we've talked.
I know. It's been over a year, and there's no good reason for that. Time just bloody flies. You're a busy man. You've got loads going on. But I'm glad you're back on. You're the first man I thought of when this kicked off. Nobody done more to debunk the whole Zika virus nonsense, the swine flu nonsense, than you did. And you've been juxtaposing this week on your excellent website how swine flu was reported and the actions taken, and this coronavirus, and they are eerily similar, John.
Yes, they are, Richie. So I've been covering what I call fake epidemics for the last 30 years. So the history matters, because when I see the same patterns repeated, I have to remind people of what the history is all about. We don't have time to go into all of the details of the past, but for example, with SARS 2003, which was supposed to be one of these major epidemics that was going to take over the world, eventually it was announced up in Canada by a biologist who worked for the World Health Organization that the SARS patients were basically all showing up with no sign of the SARS virus, which was completely absurd, because that meant they didn't have SARS, they just had ordinary flu. And yet this was being paraded as a brand new epidemic that was going to kill everybody. And if you look at the world statistics on this, they claim now that 800 people out of 7 billion died during the SARS, quote, epidemic. In the case of swine flu, in some ways that was even worse, because in the summer of 2009, the Centers for Disease Control in America was claiming there were thousands of cases of swine flu in the U.S. and people had to get the vaccine. And yet, a star reporter for CBS, Cheryl Atkinson, discovered that the CDC had actually and secretly stopped counting cases at all. I mean, that's their basic mandate, to count cases and report. So while they're saying that thousands of people have swine flu in America, they've stopped counting the cases, and she found out why. And that was because, as she told me in an interview, overwhelmingly the respiratory samples from patients that were being sent out to labs for testing came back with no sign of swine flu or any other kind of flu. And this is what the CDC was covering up. The whole thing was a hoax. There was no real epidemic. And as I discovered, by the way, CBS shut that whole investigation down after they published her article on their news website. They said they were going to put it on the national television news broadcast, but they refused to do it.
They didn't do it.
So 3 weeks after they shut the story down at CBS, I found a WebMD article in which the CDC claimed, get this, that in the summer of 2009, there were 22 million cases of swine flu in America. So this was a preposterous hoax.
Yeah.
One after another, West Nile, SARS, bird flu, Zika, on and on and on it goes. I discovered that, yes, people die. They die and they get sick for many different reasons. But pinning it on a particular virus, and then even some people going on to claim that the virus is cooked up in a lab or engineered as a weapon and all of that. If that had been true, and people have been saying this ever since West Nile way back, we would all be dead by now.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be here discussing anything. But one after another, these so-called epidemics turn out to be duds. And I've documented this wall to wall. And so when this whole thing started in China, I became very suspicious. And I started to look for proof that they had, one, actually found a coronavirus, which they claim is the cause, and two, that they have definitely identified it in patients by proper testing as opposed to tests that don't work. And I have yet to find any evidence that of either one. So that was my first step. And the second step was to go behind the scenes in Wuhan, China, which is supposed to be the center of the epidemic, and find out what else is going on there that could make people very sick, that has nothing to do with the virus, that the Chinese government might be wanting to cover up, which we can get into because I found out what that is.
Hugely important. Before you tell us what that is, and I've been on your website, so I've been reading your articles. I read them all the time. I often refer to you, my friend, on the program. You often get a mention. Your ears burn from time to time over there. You get a mention, always complimentary, because this is hugely important. And by the way, what you said a minute ago was very profound. The CBS journalist, Atkinson, the woman whom you spoke with in that very, very important article you wrote about the whole hoax around the swine flu, that CBS then buried the story and wouldn't go to the national airwaves with it, even though it was in the public interest to know that it was a hoax. That's hugely important. People should hold on to that because it happens all the time. Just before we talk about the things that the environmental factors that you think might be playing a part in Wuhan today, what do you think when you hear the UK Health Secretary tell people who've come back from China, stay indoors and avoid contact with people? Look, I don't want to sensationalise it. You know, I don't want to be over dramatic or melodramatic. But that's a bit sinister, John, isn't it? That's a little bit kind of dystopian. What do you think?
Well, Richie, what people have to realize is what's happening in China right now is unprecedented. They basically locked down 40 million people in several different major cities. And they're under quarantine. Now, this becomes a kind of icebreaker psychologically. In other words, well, if China can do it, maybe we should do it. Now you're talking about something very sinister and political. In other words, this becomes the occasion for, let's say, a president in America or prime minister in the UK suddenly saying, we're declaring a national state of emergency. The virus has spread unchecked out of control. So therefore, in the following areas, there will be no assembly or gathering of large numbers of people. We're going to cancel sporting events. We're going to cancel concerts. In fact, in public squares, we're going to outlaw large groups of people gathering for any reason. We're going to randomly check and test people by pointing wands at them. And if their body temperature is elevated, we're going to cart them away to hospitals or holding areas as probable cases of the coronavirus. We are going to have stepped up police and military presence throughout the country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if people object, then somebody official is going to say, well, look what they did in China. This was absolutely necessary. So we're going to do it here as well. In fact, in one of my articles, I mentioned that a prominent U.S. official who is part of a major funding group that funds research into vaccines, new vaccines, said that China was the, quote, silver lining in all of this, because fortunately, they have the kind of government that can control the people with an iron fist, and therefore they can help contain the spread of the epidemic. And you could hear him thinking, I wish we could do this in America.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
I shouldn't laugh,
so,
but yeah.
Yeah, really. So it's possible. And this is one of the natural consequences of propaganda campaigns to step up the idea of a killer virus that's spreading around the world, et cetera, et cetera. The other shoe to drop, of course, is the vaccine that will be rushed into production to, quote, deal with the pandemic. And that is a very dangerous event that's looming on the horizon within about 90 days. And I can give you more information about that.
That's huge. And you talked about the vaccine they rolled out for swine flu, which was nonsense, was totally unnecessary. And I was staggered to be reminded by you that they wanted every man, woman and child in your country to take that vaccine, didn't they, back then?
Yes, they did. They
wow.
did. Absolutely. And it was harmful to many people. Very serious problems like paralysis resulted in who knows how many people around the world. So that's always
the payoff. You know,
the motive behind yeah. all of this is we want to enforce the vaccine, not just bring it to market, but say that everybody must take it. Or even in the case of this hysteria, for example, to issue a presidential or prime ministerial order that everyone must take it.
Because if you don't, you might be a danger to your neighbors and you've got to take it. And this is the sort of stuff we used to see in science fiction films years ago and we thought would never happen. But to your absolute credit, you've been predicting, you've been writing about this for yonks, for years, saying, look, this is where we're going. John Rappaport is our guest, unimpeachable journalist. Absolutely. And on Health Matters, he's been all over these virus hoaxes for years now, documenting them. And the similarities, the modus operandi, how they're rolled out. And as John said, they all amount to nothing in the end, except for a lot of vaccines sold, more and more money for the big pharmaceutical companies, and governments taking more and more liberties each time in terms of what they believe they can compel people to do. When I was reading it today, I gave myself a slap in the face. I felt very Irish today, John, because because you've been writing about environmental factors that might speak to why people are getting ill in China, and I felt a bit foolish because I didn't think of it. But that's your job. That's why you've been doing what you've been doing for years. Talk to us about when you looked beyond the coronavirus into why people might be expressing respiratory problems in China. What did you find?
Okay, so Wuhan is a city of 11 million people. It's an economic juggernaut. I've seen estimates of their gross national product at a staggering $228 billion a year in Wuhan alone. So last summer, all of a sudden, unprecedented, thousands of people took to the streets in Wuhan protesting. They were protesting a couple of different things. One was there was going to be a new waste incinerator, a huge one built in the city, because they pile up gigantic amounts of waste that go into landfills. And the experience has taught the people of Wuhan and other cities in China that some of these incinerators are very faulty, and so they emit foul-smelling gases, and they cloud the atmosphere, and they cause terrible respiratory problems. On top of that, the general air quality in Wuhan is terrible. I mean terrible. There is a mixture of toxic elements that is unprecedented in the history of humankind. I found a review that spelled this out in great detail, because what you're looking at is two different ages of humanity or eras colliding. The early industrial revolution, in a sense, going on in China, along with many modern industrial and corporate manufacturing. And so the waste products of these two different eras are mixing together, and nobody knows the health effects of the synergistic combination of these elements, but they do know that many people in Wuhan are suffering from serious lung problems. I found a piece in a mainstream newspaper that mentioned a woman who had moved out of the city of Wuhan, who said that her young son had serious lung problems that resulted in repeated surgeries, and she had just moved out. And she said, I couldn't get somebody to move into my place because people don't want to move here, but I didn't care. I just had to get out. So all of a sudden, the Chinese government, faced with protests in Wuhan in the thousands of people, and protests in other Chinese cities for the same reason, air quality and pollution, are panicking, and they're thinking this could be another Tiananmen Square if we don't watch out, where the entire state apparatus is being challenged by the population, especially the middle class, who are supposed to mind their own business, but because they're being treated to horrendous pollution, they too are protesting. So all of a sudden, we find an announcement of a, quote, coronavirus that's causing all kinds of lung problems. Epidemic has nothing to do with the quality of the air. Forget about that. Don't think about that. And we have to lock down the entire city of Wuhan, so there will be no more protests. You can be sure of that. Very, very convenient indeed. Very convenient. Now, if this were the only thing that I had discovered one time, I might say, well, I don't know. But time and time again, I have discovered this strategy in fake epidemics. you look at places where they are supposedly emanating or originating, like Africa, and you see horrendous conditions in the environment, contaminated water supplies, lack of basic sanitation, sewage running directly into untreated water, overcrowding in cities, starvation, hunger, poverty, war, corporations stealing farmland from the people and never giving it back, corporations polluting the land, the soil, the water, the air, etc., etc. All of this has to be covered up, you see, because local dictators can't be blamed, and transnational corporations, of course, can't be blamed for maintaining this horrendous state of affairs when these environmental tragedies could easily be fixed, but they aren't. So how do we cover it up? And time again, the virus turns out to be the greatest cover story in the world.
They use the virus.
It's the virus. It's nothing but the virus that's making people sick and dying and so on and so forth. And people stand up and salute this because doctors are telling them this, medical researchers are telling them this. People have no idea what goes on in labs and research. They have no idea about different diagnostic tests for viruses and how incompetent they are. How people who are experiencing mere flu symptoms that are quite ordinary are suddenly told they have a new epidemic disease without any testing at all. So people salute the virus and they say, well, that must be it. Okay, let's, you know, what else is on TV?
I nearly asked you a stupid question there. I was going to say, why don't we hear from, you know, Chinese medical men and women who might be convinced of your theory? But that would have been a stupid question, because obviously China exerts very strict controls over the internet there, and it also exerts, as we've seen this week, very strict controls over people individually. So you might very well have academic men and women in China who think, hang on a second, we have these environmental issues here, air quality, that might be playing its part here, but they're not going to get a hearing. And they're certainly not going to get a hearing outside of China. So I nearly asked the stupid question, but I didn't. John Rappaport is our guest. NoMoreFakeNews.com. That's where you'll find John. He's on Twitter as well. There's only one John Rappaport. Follow him on Twitter. I'll tweet a link out to where you can find him there. Do you know, it's funny you mentioned the incinerator, John. Many years ago, when I first started out in radio, my home city, which is Waterford in Ireland, our local politicians were very interested in bringing incinerators into the city to deal with the problems of landfill and, you know, over, you know, running out of landfill space and stuff like that. So they went to Scandinavia and they went to Germany. But they were accompanied by totally genuinely independent men and women from universities who were independent, who wanted to have a look at these incinerators and the output, the emissions from these incinerators. And I, as a journalist at the time, met one or two of these academic men and women. And they said, Richie, we're not from the green movement. This is an academic call here. This is just a university call. These incinerators are terrible. What they will be pumping into the atmosphere and into the skies around your city, your town, is toxic crap that will give people respiratory problems, that will give people symptoms like pneumonia and stuff like this. This is back in the very late 90s, John. And you've talked to me today about incinerators in Wuhan. You know, this is a city, an industrial city, which has got air quality problems anyway. There must be something to what you're telling me today. There must be.
Well, yes, there definitely is something. And I can assure you that if a Chinese scientist or medical researcher dared to step forward and say, wait a minute, we're on the wrong track here. This is not a virus that's creating all this illness. This is air quality. This guy would be put in prison, tortured, shot, killed, whatever. It wouldn't just be his credentials would be stripped away. This would be the end of him or her. That's how iron-fisted the regime is over there. So nobody is going to be talking out of school unless they want to, you know, go to the afterlife.
Yeah.
And even then, the idea that this would get out in the news media over there is preposterous. It would never happen. So we're looking at, let me just talk a little bit about the vaccines, because this is a vital issue.
90 days, you said, but I'm not going to interrupt you. You have the floor. Talk about the vaccines. But just remind me, you said that they're looking at trying to get a vaccine for this within the next 3 months. Is that right?
That's right. For listeners in the UK, the biggest medical research facility in the world is called the US National Institutes of Health. It's a government agency. It has gigantic funding in the billions of dollars. So one of the chief executives of that institute, Anthony Fauci, announced that within 90 days, he wants to start human testing or run human testing of a new vaccine against the dire coronavirus. And this is all hands on deck. It's a major, major rush job, et cetera, et cetera. So what is he talking about? Well, it turns out that he and the U.S. government are partnering with a company called Moderna to produce a type of vaccine called an RNA vaccine. And without going into a long technical description, this vaccine basically inserts a molecule into a human body that then produces something like the coronavirus inside the body, which supposedly, according to the theory, the human immune system responds to well, and that's a rehearsal in case the real coronavirus comes along later, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Typical vaccine theory, but with a new twist. Well, so I began looking into this, and what do I find out? I find out that this technology, RNA vaccines, has never been openly used on the public before. It's never been released for commercial use or licensed. It's never been tested properly for safety of any kind. And yet, within 90 days, they're going to unleash one of these, this vaccine on untold millions of people. So I looked further and discovered that one of the challenges, as it was called, is the possible adverse effects of such a vaccine. One of these would be what's called autoimmune problems, which means that the vaccine causes the human immune system to spiral out of control, and the immune system begins attacking other parts of the body. So the body, in a sense, in a very real sense, goes to war against itself. That's the meaning of autoimmune. Untested, unlicensed, never before used on the public, and with a short, possibly human test or even no test at all, they're going to release this vaccine to millions of people. This is a guinea pig experiment worldwide in which they will stand back and see what happens.
To a completely unsuspecting public who've bought the scare stories about. And you know what, John, it's a funny one that, you know, because as somebody who's had problems with my lungs over the years, I'm a non-smoker, I'm an athlete, but I've had pneumonia, bronchitis, ever since I was a kid. I've had pneumonia 3 times. I get very nervous, you know, when I hear things about respiratory problems, about the lungs filling with water. And if I didn't know John Rappaport, and if I'd never worked in the independent media, I'd have that vaccine, John. I'd have it in a heartbeat.
Of course. Of course. And so will millions of other people who would just say, sure.
Yeah.
You see, but once you begin to take apart the whole story and see that the whole idea of one virus causing all of this illness is really unproven completely, then the idea of a vaccine against that virus becomes preposterous. And then on top of that, if the vaccine shows a propensity for great harm, never having been tested properly, and it's suddenly released on people, now we're talking about an incredible potential here for destruction. And let me assure your listeners that if that were to happen, if that is what's going to happen here, the illness and death and dying that will occur from the vaccine will be marked down to the epidemic itself.
Can I ask you this question? Sorry to interrupt you. Can I ask you? I've got to ask you this because I always make a point of mentioning when I introduce you that every major publication that you can name has run your byline over the years to your absolute credit. And then because you're a man of integrity and because you go where the evidence takes you, they're not so inclined to want to publish you anymore, although your work is impeccable. And that's their problem, not yours. And thankfully, you've got nomorefakenews.com where people can read your articles. How frustrating is it for you that all of these hoaxes amount to nothing and there's no follow-up from the media? Because it kills me, but yet I don't have your kind of dog in the fight, John. I mean, I watched Sky News the other day and I'm watching it and I've got my little tablet in my hand and I'm reading your article. And I'm reading your article and I'm getting angry because the producers on Sky News know that all of the previous hoaxes, swine flu, SARS, all that crap, all that nonsense, never materialised. There's no follow-up anymore. What your articles have done in the last couple of weeks, you always do it, but on this issue, is you've gone back and shown the fallibility. You know, you've shown the great glaring holes in the narrative of these, virus hoaxes. It must drive you mad that the media doesn't do that, because it's so easy to do. You know, what happened to swine flu? Oh, that just went away. Apparently we were all going to die. What happened to Zika? Oh, that just went away. Does that drive you mad, John, watching that?
Not really. If it did, I wouldn't be here. But
yeah, I suppose, yeah.
My strategy, you see, almost from the beginning, because I started writing as a reporter in 1982, so I've been at this 18, 20, 38 years now. Yeah. My strategy, I named my website No More Fake News in 2001, so I was on to them from a very early time. And my strategy has always been attack. In other words, I'm not sitting here with my blood boiling and just being frustrated. There's only one opening as far as I'm concerned, and that is you attack the media and you reveal who they are, what they are, why they are robots, and who controls them. And you start taking apart their stories one by one and analyzing them and showing how ridiculous they are. Now, it's true that in the early days, my blood did boil more frequently. And I did go nuts at times, in a sense. I mean, I didn't go haywire. I just got very angry.
Yeah.
But then I would just sit down and start writing and start working and give lectures and go on shows and talk and so on and so forth. And lo and behold, I found an audience, people who and have never been able to analyze what that audience is. In other words, there is no profile. There is no demographic. There is no, oh, well, we're reaching the XYZ people. No, nothing adds up. It's individuals wherever they are in the world, who decided to think and wake up and figure out what's going on.
Brilliant point.
And so that's been my strategy all along. You know, I would say that at my height in working for doing articles for outlets other than my own, I was never widely published in gigantic major publications. I mean, it was always somewhat alternative, except in a few cases where it was decidedly very mainstream. But even there, in the so-called alternative press, that press became heavily politicized somewhere in the 1990s, I would say. And I began to recognize this is not going to work for me. And so in 2001, after a period of kind of pounding my head against the wall, trying to figure out what to do, I said, well, you know, there's this crazy thing called the internet. Maybe I can get on here and let's see what happens. And lo and behold, it worked. So as long as I have that outlet and shows like yours, there's nothing that I can't say or write. And any research that I do can be exposed.
Yeah, you'll always have platforms like ours. And platforms like ours, when I say like ours, I mean radio programs. Our listenership is increasing exponentially. I don't say that to boast or to brag. I don't. I say it because it is, and we can prove it. And it's because people are tired of listening to interviews where the person gets 5 or 6 minutes and they don't get any time to really expand on what it is they're trying to say. They're tired of attack journalism. People want to hear conversations. There's no doubt about that. Before I ask you, because we're going to go till the top of the hour, maybe just beyond the top of the hour. That's the beauty of running your own operation. You can go as long as you want. Before I ask you about vaccines and the ultimate payoff, I bet you, because of your longevity and because of your integrity and your ability, I bet from time to time you do get confidential emails from people who work in mainstream media. You must do. Who say to you, John, yes, it is as bad as you think it is, and I wish I could do what you do. Because once in a blue moon, I will get an email myself. I've got friends who work at the BBC, and people do say, Richie, I envy you on the one hand, because I'd love to be able to just do whatever I want. But on the other hand, I've got that security of the paycheck coming in every month, and I do have a family, so at the moment, I can't break away from it. I'm imagining you probably get a lot of emails over the years like that as well. Mainstream people thinking, John, I'd love to do what you do.
Yes, I've talked to mainstream reporters, and the conversations have been very interesting.
Yeah.
Because they turn out pretty much like you just said. We can't do this, we can't do that. I was very interested in the mechanics of the psychology of these people, and so I would ask them questions designed to elicit, you know, their comments. And it was clear to me that in most cases, mainstream reporters instinctively know where they can't go. They don't need to be told. They don't need to have editors come down on them and say, you can't do this and never do that and so on. They know. They understand the landscape. And so occasionally when they cross the line, they'll feel it and they'll be reminded, no, you don't do that, can't do that. And they understand their careers are on the line, and that if they do it too often, even propose a story that goes beyond conventional limits, that their editors are going to start looking at them in a different way and saying, well, this guy could be trouble. We might not want to keep him or her. And if we don't keep him or her, they're going to find it very difficult to find another job on the same level as they have now. They're going to decline. They're going to go down. And this is the mindset. Now, I've also talked to medical research people and doctors about some of my findings. And I can remember one case very much like what we've been talking about the past 45 minutes here, where there was a virus and it was said to be the cause of a major, major epidemic. And I said to this guy, who was a very well-known virologist, don't you see that there are major problems with the proof, the supposed proof that this virus is causing the epidemic? I mean, surely you must be aware of this. And so there was a pause, and he said, yes, he said, there are those of us, I can still hear that phrase, there are those of us who understand that this situation has been politicized, and we've chosen to stand back and take a pass on it. That was the way he put it, not to get involved. He wouldn't come out and say, yeah, the evidence is ridiculous and it's never been proven that the virus causes this epidemic or, you know, anything close to it. That's the way he put it to me. Well, this guy was a professor at a major university teaching students all about viruses and so on and so forth.
Right, right.
You know, and he just continued on with his career because he knew. And I've also talked to a couple of major researchers who did step out of line and paid the price, heavily paid the price. Funding cut off, research grants canceled. Students of theirs were told not to do graduate work with them because their future reputations would be tainted forever. Mm-hmm. If they did, they lost their lab privileges. They were made into pariahs. They were mocked and criticized and exiled from their own colleagues and their own professions. You know, the whole shooting match was leveled at them. And they kept on. They said, all right, I can deal with this. I'll do the best I can, but I'm not going to stand down and retract anything that I've said. And they didn't. And they paid the price.
Yeah, we've seen it over the years. We've seen people lose tenure because they, you know, on a point of principle, something which shouldn't have cost them tenure. I mean, Norman Finkelstein, the great Jewish academic, is one that comes to mind. He accused Alan Dershowitz, the famous lawyer, of plagiarism. He proved it. But because Dershowitz was establishment to the bone and Norman was a bit of an antagonist to the Israeli government, Norman was destroyed by Paul University. They took his tenure because he spoke up. I know it's on a different issue. You're right, John. You're 100% right. John Rappaport is our guest. In the time we have left, the $64 million question. Now, don't think that I'm stupid and that I haven't been reading you for over 10 years, because I have. And I know the answer you're going to give me. But a lot of our listeners will be, because we're going out on commercial radio here in the UK, as well known as you are, some of our listeners will be hearing you for the first time. So I want to ask you, they're desperate to get vaccines into us. More and more vaccines. New vaccines. Weird and wonderful vaccines. And they're inventing new reasons to get vaccines into us. There will be listeners who will wonder, what does John think is the real reason for this? Why did they want to give us so many vaccines? Does it go beyond the enormous financial windfall for the big pharma companies? Is there something they're trying to do to us through these vaccines? Or is that just a crazy conspiracy theory? You and I have butted heads. We haven't butted heads, actually. We've talked about this going back years. But for people who don't know your thoughts on that, what do you think?
Okay. Well, let me give you another example from the present first. The vaccine that I mentioned a few minutes ago, the RNA vaccine that's never been used on the public, that's in the pipeline to be maybe brought out in 90 days. This is not the only experimental vaccine that's in the works for the so-called epidemic, China epidemic. There are several. And from what I can see, they're all experimental. And there's another one called the DNA vaccine. Now, I don't know whether this will be used or not, but I've written about it before. This is a whole class of coming vaccines where DNA is actually synthesized and injected into the body as a kind of vaccine.
Jesus.
Now, I am now referring to a mainstream article that I've quoted in print several times from the New York Times. I'm going to try to peg the date in my mind, April 15th, 1995. Could it be as early as that? 2015. And what it said was basically, when they inject this DNA, get this, it alters the genetic makeup of the recipient permanently. Permanently. And then they asked a Nobel laureate by name of David Baltimore what he thought of this. And he said, well, he said, I could imagine some people objecting to having their DNA altered permanently.
Yeah, just a few.
Just a few, huh?
Yeah.
If they knew. So when we talk about what they want to put in your body, keep that one in mind. All right, so on to your larger question. Beyond the profits, control. Control of the population. I'm going to say that as early as 2001, in writing, I said, of all the cartels that run this world, the most dangerous long-term is the medical cartel, because it appears to be politically neutral. It waves no political flags or banners. It claims to be healing and only care about the goodness of its work and helping people. And in some areas, it does indeed help people. If you're lying on the street after an auto accident and your body is broken, you're going to want the very best emergency crisis team to put you back together again, indeed. And if that were the totality of modern medicine, fine, but of course it goes way beyond that. So control is the issue. There is no better way to control the population of the planet long term than to enlist and enroll them from pregnancy through birth, through life, to death, as a member, a card-carrying member, as a patient in the medical cartel, diagnosed with 40 or 50 different diseases and mental disorders throughout their lifetime, prescribed many, many toxic drugs, injected with vaccines which admittedly contain toxic elements like aluminum, which is a heavy neurotoxin, other toxic chemicals, germs, some of which are random and occur as contaminants in the manufacturing process, unavoidable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, injected into babies to stimulate their immune system when the babies have no immune system to speak of. So how could the vaccines possibly work, et cetera, on and on and on. Some vaccines causing severe lifelong brain damage, nervous system damage called autism, on and on and on and on. So you have damage and you have control. You have making people less free, less powerful, less strong, less independent, less clear-minded, less able to see what's going on in the world, less free, less independent, less capable of resistance under the burden of toxicity that builds and builds and builds from medical drugs and vaccines. And you have the control factor, controlling people from birth all the way through their lives. Now, I'm not saying that every doctor on every street corner is aware of this or is consciously participating in this. That's never the way it happens. You have true believers. You have people who are picking up a paycheck. You have people that want promotion, status. You have people who want security. You have people who just want to maintain their positions of influence. But way, way, and the profits, of course, for pharmaceutical companies, but way, way, way above that, it appears clear to me that there are people directing the show, so to speak, producing the stage play, who absolutely know what's going on from top to bottom and are fronting it, backing it, funding it, participating it, for the reasons that I just spelled out.
And you know what? We're going to wrap up in a few minutes. But I want you to... I used to think guys like you, with the greatest respect, I never doubted your intelligence. You know, your massive brain. But years ago, when I first heard of people like you, I thought you were crazy. You know, well, that's the default position for somebody who gets all of his news from the BBC and Sky News. The default position is when a man succinctly puts information in the public domain, the challenges, you know, established thinking. The default position is, oh, Rappaport's mad, he's crazy. You know, Ike is mad, he's crazy. Jim Morris, mad, crazy. The default position, but not anymore. I believe you're right, because I believe you've put more than circumstantial evidence on your website and in your broadcast. It's more than circumstantial. It's horrendous to contemplate what you've
just
said.
Let me just interject here, Richie.
Yeah, jump in, John.
I know we're wrapping up.
Yeah.
Maybe 5-10 years ago, it occurred to me, chapter and verse, I'm uncovering scandal after scandal, lie after lie, damage after damage, et cetera, et cetera. So am I going to suppose that the highest possible people in positions of control in, say, the medical arena are unaware of all of this? That I'm the only one who knows this?
Yeah.
You know, when I've been able to ferret a great deal of it out of public sources? Of course not. They know, and they don't do anything about it. They just continue on what they're doing. So that means culpability. Even if you don't ascribe conscious intent on their part to destroy as part of the puzzle, at the very least you say, well, they're standing aside and letting their machine roll over people and destroy them in gigantic numbers, which I haven't even gotten into here today. And they're doing nothing about it. So that makes them entirely culpable. I mean, if you, and I'm talking to a listener now, any listener, if you were a doctor and you knew that the drug that you were giving a patient was highly toxic and that it could kill him or maim him severely for the rest of his life, and yet you can, I mean, would you continue to do that? If you just became aware of that, would you continue? Well, there are many people who do. And there are many people who market these drugs and promote them and write fake studies about them and get them published in major journals and get government public health agencies to approve their use on the public, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So common sense tells me this is not just an accident or something that organically evolved of a horrendous nature, that there are people in the shadows high up who absolutely know what's going on.
By design. What I was you were right to interrupt me, by the way. You were right to interrupt me. What I was building up to was, it's horrendous, but yet you carry on, and the quality of your writing is brilliant. And your ability to connect dots is brilliant. So you believe, because I can't imagine you would do it otherwise, you believe that they can be stopped, otherwise you wouldn't do it. I want to finish on that positive note, because I always get positivity from you. I feel it coming off you. You think we'll stop them.
Yes, I do. But I don't take the short view. I take the long view. And that is very important to me. In other words, you fight the fight you choose, but you also recognize that you're doing it over the long term. Even if you're not around for an unspecified period of time, however many decades, or whatever it takes, that you believe that ultimately the whole rotten, corrupt system can be overthrown and something much better can replace it, which I do and always have. But also, I take heart from the fight itself and from exposing what's going on. I don't sit down and say, oh my God, I've got to do this.
Yeah.
There are times when I just sort of take a little break. Sure, absolutely. But in the main, I stay committed because it's a good fight. Because I want to do it, and I take energy from doing it.
I want to ask you this. It's been a real tonic, no pun intended, having you back on. It's been no, it has, and it's been too long. You coming on, I don't have producers and editors. It's just me. I'm the chief cook and bottle washer. And because I'm a political journalist, I do let health matters kind of go by, not go by the wayside, but I'm not on top of it much. And yours is, you know, an incredibly important voice. So I know you're not a diva, so I can say this to you. Don't wait to be invited back on. When there's something going on that needs to be, I mean, everything you write about is important. But when you want to come on for a chat, don't wait for me to ask you. Do you hear me? Get on the Skype. Get on the Skype and say, Alan, you've not had me on for, you know, a couple of months. You know, I'll make a note of it anyway. But I love having you on, and I've missed having you on. Because this is vital work you're doing, I think. And I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. I mean that. And our audience loves you. Integrity shines through your writing. And it's really important.
I appreciate
important.
It, Richie. And I enjoy being on too, believe me. So I will reach out and you reach out and we'll do it soon again.
Absolutely. We'll do it more often. That's a promise. Thanks for blowing the lid off of this nonsense and going back in time to show how these viruses are hoaxes and why. It's stellar work, John. I really mean that, mate. And again, I'm not, you know, as we say in Ireland, I'm not plomosing. It's a great Irish word, plomosing. I'm not basically kissing your arse. I really do believe it. I wouldn't say it otherwise. NoMoreFakeNews.com. You've been listening to John Rappaport. We've gone into overtime because, well, it bloody deserved it. Thanks again, John. Godspeed to you. And I can't wait till you come back on again.
You too. And say hello to David for me.
I will indeed, mate. Thanks for that. Bye
Thank
for
you
now.
Very much, Richie.
The brilliant John Rappaport live on the line from New York City. Thanks to him for his time today. Two terrific journalists on the program today. John Waters in the first hour and John Rappaport in the second hour. That's about it. We've gone into overtime. I can't get the show on a two-hour loop now at the top of the hour, but who cares? We can do that. I want to say thanks again to John Waters. JohnWaters.ie. Vote John 2020 on Twitter. And you've heard John Rappaport there, nomorefakenews.com. And if you put John Rappaport into Twitter, there's only one John Rappaport. Follow him there. Do read the articles on nomorefakenews.com. Read them. It's brilliant how he's connected the dots over the last 20 years, these fake epidemic viruses, and how similar they are in terms of how they are reported, and also in terms of the solutions being offered. And then they disappear. Because I guarantee you, in 3 or 4 weeks' time, there'll be no more coronavirus. You won't hear of it. You won't hear a word of it. I'll be back with you tomorrow, 9:30. The newspaper crap on YouTube. Until then, bye from me. Bye now.